East capital Beirut, as the regime's carnage shows no sign of abating. Footage caught on camera shows the moment an Israeli missile hit the area. Lebanese media report that Israeli warplanes fired missiles at the Burj al Barajna neighborhood. Beirut's Obeidi area has also been targeted. The number of casualties and the extent of the damage are unclear, but reports say several buildings were destroyed there to the south of the country. Five Lebanese paramedics were among six people killed in an Israeli strike on a civil defense center in the Nabatea area. Dozens of rescue workers were also killed in Israeli attacks on eastern city of Baalbek. The death toll from the Israeli aggression since October last year is now near 3,400, and more than 14,400 others have been wounded. The Lebanese resistance movement Hezbollah has launched several retaliatory operations against Israeli targets in the occupied territories. In the latest of such operations, Hezbollah fighters fired several rockets targeting the occupied port city of Haifa. Israeli media confirmed one person has been injured in the attack. In another operation, Hezbollah fired a barrage of missiles against the Shraga military base in the northern parts of the occupied territories. A day earlier, the group targeted the regime's Tel Haim base in Tel Aviv for the first time with a volley of missiles. Hezbollah said the targeted base belonged to the intelligence division of the Israeli army. Iran has once again expressed its unwavering support for the Lebanese government and people amid the ongoing Israeli aggression.
The Islamic Republic of Iran will stand by the Lebanese nation and Lebanese officials in all situations, especially in the current situation, which is tough. The situation is tough, and that is imposed by the Israeli regime.
Lahrijani also vowed that Tehran will continue its support for the resistance in Lebanon. He made the remarks in Beirut after meeting with the Lebanese Prime Minister Najib Mirati and Parliament Speaker Nabih Berri. The former Iranian Parliament Speaker said he had delivered a message from Iran's leader to Berri. He said Iran will support any decision by the Lebanese government and resistance. Lahrijani said Iran is trying to resolve issues, but Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and his friends are sabotaging the process. The Iranian advisor traveled to Beirut from the Syrian capital, Damascus, where he met with President Bashar al-Assad. Political analyst John Bosnich says the visit by the Iranian delegation to Lebanon sends a clear message to the Israeli regime that it should stop its aggression in the region.
This is going to have to be a clear message to the Israeli regime that they cannot wage illegal warfare, not only inside Palestine, but in the entire surrounding region. Iran, in this case, is acting as a local enforcer of international law. Israel has been attacking illegally. It has occupied its own so-called state in Palestine illegally, and it is now attempting to extend its tentacles to control the entire surrounding region. Well, I think that any visit by a high-ranking Iranian official to the region is not just a counterbalance, but it's a most serious warning that this behavior by Israel is not going to be tolerated. So when we talk about counterbalance, that's sort of tit-for-tat, small adjustments between various powers. This is far more than a counterbalance. This is a warning at the highest possible level.
We're now joined by our correspondent, Mariam Saleh, who's joining us from the Lebanese capital, Beirut, to bring us up to speed on all the latest developments with regards to the ongoing Israeli incursions and massacre that's taking place against the people of Lebanon, and also with the latest updates on the continued retaliatory attacks and operations being carried out by the Lebanese resistance, Hezbollah. Mariam?
Well, first of all, we are here at the embassy, Iranian embassy in Beirut, and Mr. Lahrijani is currently meeting with leaders of the political factions in Lebanon, also some members of the parliament as well. and we expect that there will be a statement after this meeting where we get some insight, of course, on what the discussions spoke about, whether with his meetings with officials and also with the heads of the political parties. This also comes at a time when we just minutes ago heard the breaking of the sound barrier by the Israeli warplanes, which continue to hover over the skies in Lebanon. Of course, we know earlier also in the last few hours, the Israelis destroyed several buildings in the southern suburbs of Beirut, and it seems that now it is different than what it was before. Before, the Israelis would send some warnings, destroy some buildings, then keep it calm for a few days. Now it seems that we have daily warnings and daily destruction, which seems to be systematic on a daily basis, targeting buildings. And there is fear that in some neighborhoods there are still people who remain, and that there might be some attacks that were given, that were launched without warning. This is what we saw in the last 2 days. Fortunately, they have been evacuated by most people, since there is an experience when it comes to this, to the Israelis and how they target areas without giving prior warning. And so all the entire suburbs have been almost completely evacuated. But there are still, of course, attacks in various areas in southern Lebanon. In the Bekaa last night, we saw that there were various paramedics, a big number of paramedics actually, that were killed in South Lebanon as well as in the Bekaa. And usually these paramedics are going to go for relief efforts, lifting the rubble, looking for whether there are any survivors, or even to remove and retrieve the bodies of the martyrs. And still they are being attacked by the Israelis, whether they're drones or the warplanes. And that has caused, of course, this crisis and this catastrophe with the killing of the paramedics and the medical staff. In all of Lebanon, we know at the same time we have various operations from Hezbollah. They have issued various statements, and it seems that the focus of the resistance has been in the last few weeks mostly on making sure that they stave off all the attempts by the Israeli military to launch incursions into Lebanon. We know that they launched several attacks. There were at least two or three attacks against the Israeli forces that are at the gates of Khiyam. In addition to another town, which is Talusa, there was an Israeli force that were targeted by Hezbollah at least twice today. Hezbollah also said that they targeted groups of Israeli soldiers in the vicinity or the outskirts of the town of Markaba and Marun al-Ras. This is in addition to the launching of rockets towards the settlements of Kiryat Shmona and Sasa. And earlier, of course, in the day, Hezbollah declared that they targeted Aqqa and specifically the Sharaba military base. And earlier, of course, the base in the south of Haifa, which has been the subject of Hezbollah's targeting very extensively. We've seen that there are also several attacks against various military bases, and even the war ministry of cabinet headquarters in the center of the regime in Tel Aviv. Of course, Hezbollah has proven through this that they are able to continue to launch their rockets and also able to take on the Israeli forces in close border combat at the border as well. Of course, this comes at a time when it seems that there will be an elongation of the war, although there was a lot of questions today on whether the U.S. ambassador, after meeting Birri, we know that she met Birri, but there were conflicting reports on whether the U.S. did actually give a proposal to the Lebanese government, to the Lebanese officials, to give a certain proposal for a ceasefire. That is not clear up until now. It is not clear what the U.S. is trying to ask from the Lebanese government and what the Lebanese government might accept, but they have been adamant on saying that any agreement should stress the Lebanese sovereignty, especially after the war.
Thanks a lot, Mariam Saleh, joining us from the Lebanese capital, Beirut. Elsewhere, the Israeli regime is pressing ahead with its genocidal war on Gaza, killing more Palestinians across the besieged territory. In the latest attacks, a drone struck an area near Gaza City's Sheikh Radwan neighborhood, killing six Palestinians. The strike also injured a number of others. The Israeli military also targeted neighborhoods west of the nearby Jabalia refugee camp in northern Gaza, which is under weeks-long siege and offensive. In the central city of Deir al-Balah, three Palestinians, including a child and a woman, were killed in the regime's bombings. Two more Palestinians also lost their lives in the town of Al-Nas, northeast of Rafah City. Since the onset of the U.S.-Israeli genocide in Gaza in October of last year, more than 43,700 Palestinians have been killed. Nearly 103,500 people have also been injured. Political analyst Saad Nimr tells us about the Israeli motive behind its intensified military offensive in northern Gaza.
It's quite clear that the Israeli are still going on with their genocidal war, especially in the north of Gaza, Jabalia, Beit Lahia, and the area, in order to evacuate all the Palestinian people from these areas. That goes with the plan that they put forward just a few weeks ago, and now we are talking about more than 42 days of this campaign into Gaza and into north of Gaza, and especially Jabalia refugee camp. The Israeli orders to the Palestinians were to evacuate the area, and those who don't want to evacuate, then they will be considered as enemy, and they will be targeted. And so far, we are talking more than 2,000 Palestinians who have been killed in Jabalia and the surrounding area since this operation started 42 days ago. But at the same time, there is something quite important to notice, that on the one hand, you have the Palestinian resistance still working there, and they are still giving the Israeli lots of casualties, whether in their vehicles or in their lives. And also the other thing, which is the people of Jabalia is also refusing to leave.
A recent UN report has described the Israeli war on Gaza as genocidal, expressing deep alarm over the humanitarian crisis there. The report was issued amid incessant attacks and unchecked violence by the Israeli regime, especially in northern Gaza, where weeks-long siege and offensive have claimed thousands of lives.
Committee of the UN's Human Rights Office says Israel's war in Gaza is consistent with the characteristics of genocide. In its latest report, it pointed to mass civilian casualties and life-threatening conditions intentionally imposed by Israel on Palestinians since October 7 last year.
The developments in this report led this special committee to conclude that the policies and practices of Israel are consistent with the characteristics of genocide. The targeting of Palestinians as a group, the life-threatening conditions imposed on Palestinians in Gaza through warfare and restrictions on humanitarian aid resulting in physical destruction, increased miscarriages, and stillbirth are violations under international law. Civilians have been indiscriminately and disproportionately killed en masse in Gaza.
The UN committee criticized the regime for destroying vital water and sanitation systems, contaminating the environment, and inflicting long-term harm on future generations. The report highlighted that Israel is using starvation as a weapon of war. This is consistent with findings from the UN's Famine Review Committee, which warns that famine may already be occurring in Gaza.
Already in October, nearly 133,000 people faced catastrophic food insecurity. And the integrated phase, food security phase classification released on 17th of October warned that under a reasonable worst-case scenario, a risk of famine existed for the whole of the Gaza Strip between November 2024 and April 2025.
The United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestinian Refugees has raised urgent alarms about the looming threat of famine in northern Gaza, highlighting the severe humanitarian crisis that continues to unfold in the besieged Strip.
Famine is imminent, if not already happening, in the besieged north. And while we receive testimonies from people on the ground asking, begging for pieces of bread, for water, the United Nations remains denied access to this area.
As the humanitarian crisis deepens in Gaza, the world continues to stay silent over the Israeli genocide. The need for immediate intervention has never been more pressing now, as the lives of countless civilians hang in the balance amid U.S.-Israeli genocidal war.
The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has expressed readiness for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza, stressing that Israel has not put forth any serious proposals so far. A Hamas political bureau member said the group is ready for a ceasefire if a deal is presented and respected. Bassem Naim stressed, back in July, Israeli Premier Benjamin Netanyahu rejected a well-defined and well-brokered deal. Naim also urged the incoming U.S. President Donald Trump to pressure Israel to end its aggression. Months of Gaza truce mediation efforts during Biden's presidency have produced no results, As Israel refuses to halt the attacks, the regime has instead increased pressure on Gazans by restricting aid. Well, another sign of increasing international support for Palestinians and Israel's growing global isolation, the UN General Assembly has overwhelmingly approved a resolution backing Palestinians' right to self-determination, independence, and freedom from Israeli occupation. The resolution stresses that the right is inalienable, unconditional, and non-negotiable. It rejected any so-called security measures imposed by Israel as preconditions. A total of 170 countries voted in favor of the resolution, including Canada, Australia, and all EU member states. There were only 6 votes against the resolution, 2 of which were by Israel and the U.S. The resolution also condemned as crimes against humanity and genocide, the Israeli atrocities against Palestinians, particularly in Gaza. In May, the UN General Assembly also resoundingly voted to back the Palestinian bid for full UN membership. At least 15 people have been killed and 16 others injured following an Israeli airstrike on the Syrian capital city of Damascus. According to the Syrian army, the air raid struck a number of residential buildings in the Meza neighborhood of Damascus and the Qudsaya area in the country, in the city's countryside. It added that the attack was launched from the direction of the occupied Golan Heights. Israel has confirmed the airstrike, claiming that it targeted the headquarters of the Palestinian Islamic Jihad. However, videos published online showed ambulances carrying civilian casualties, including women and children. Israel has been conducting airstrikes on Syria since 2013. However, its attacks intensified after the beginning of the Gaza genocide last October. And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
Imam Sajjad, peace be upon him, has said, "Whenever I remember the martyrdom of the children of Fatima, peace be upon her, my eyes filled with tears."
The Limelight.
American officials continue to be the Zionist regime's willing enablers to carry on with its general starvation plan in a systematic and phased mini-genocide. Concerning this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Please stay tuned for more. Palestine Chronicle wrote, George Orwell's dystopian foresight could easily find new expressions in the ongoing Israeli wars of genocide in Gaza and Lebanon. Much like War is Peace, the Biden administration and the European Union have contributed to creating phrases such as aggression is self-defense, murder is collateral damage, safe areas are death traps, and humanitarian aid is a starvation diet. After enduring a full year of Zionist terror, extreme torment, and military occupation, fear never conquered the will of the Gazans. Despite the complete Zionist blockade, abetted by the Egyptian regime, and the stark imbalance in military power, Gaza's collective resistance, by all means necessary, remained steadfast and resilient. Notwithstanding the above, Benjamin Netanyahu has not succeeded in achieving any of his declared objectives. For instance, less than 7% of the freed Israeli captives outward Israeli objective were recovered by force. Perhaps because the Zionist regime prime minister's undeclared Zionist objectives, such as land grabs in the West Bank, under the shadow of the Gaza genocide, took precedence over pursuing a proven venue for the release of Israeli prisoners. Netanyahu's war success can be only measured by the Zionist regime's scale of vengeance, as the toll of the murdered and injured has reached 150,000. Gaza has been turned into a living hell, a war that pervasively and systematically diminished Gaza's economic capacity, following an 18-year blockade that crippled the economy and forced upon it an ever-increasing sense of dependency. Yet, the Zionist regime failed to bring any part of Gaza into submission. As a result, several Israeli generals, led by former National Security Advisor, Israeli Major General Giora Eiland, contrived a new approach, General's Plan, to ethnically cleanse northern Gaza. The General's Plan is not exclusively a military strategy, but rather an orchestrated non-combatant action, euphemistically termed to mask its true intention, genocide and ethnic cleansing through starvation. It calls first for the complete isolation of northern Gaza from the rest of the Gaza Strip. Second, compartmentalize northern Gaza into separate quarters and declare each section as a war zone, forcing civilians to leave or become legitimate military targets. The initial phase, which began in early October, blocked aid trucks from reaching the north and then segregated the Jabalia camp from its surroundings. In other words, genocide by attrition, one quarter at a time in a slow motion. As part of the general's starvation plan, the Zionist regime bombed the only UN distribution center in Jabalia camp on Monday, October 14, 2024, murdering 10 civilians queuing to receive food aid. Since last October, around 400,000 civilians remain in northern Gaza out of the original 1.2 million. Many refuse to evacuate despite the unbearable conditions. They know from historical experience that evacuation is an Israeli alias for ethnic cleansing. Once they leave, they may never return, as happened in 1948. They also saw what happened to those who evacuated. Many were killed during their trek, while others were murdered in the Zionist regime death traps, otherwise known as designated safe areas. The Biden administration has been whitewashing Zionist regime use of starvation as a method of warfare since October 9, 2023, when the Zionist regime minister of war declared no electricity, no food, no fuel, everything is closed. However, On October 15, 2024, a little over a year since the Zionist minister's declaration, the American Secretaries of State, Anwar, sent Israeli regime officials a letter giving them another grace period of 30 days to allow food aid into North Gaza or risk a restriction of U.S. military assistance to Israel. The new warning feels like a classic case of a déjà vu. In April 2024, the Biden administration issued a similar warning to the Zionist regime ahead of a report that was being prepared by American officials examining Israel's violation of the Lehi Law, particularly subsection 6201. The law stipulates that the U.S. should not provide assistance to any country that prohibits or otherwise restricts, directly or indirectly, the transport or delivery of United States humanitarian assistance. Following that warning, U.S. government agencies and officials concluded that Israel was blocking American humanitarian aid to Gaza. The U.S. Agency for International Development notified the State Department of Israel's arbitrary denial, restriction, and impediments of U.S. aid to Gaza residents. In addition, the State Department's Refugee Bureau issued a similar opinion, stating that facts on the ground indicate U.S. humanitarian assistance is being restricted. Even after those palpable reports from the two U.S. agencies, the Israeli Tzionim, an American Secretary of State, told Congress on May 10th that Israel does not restrict the transport or delivery of U.S. humanitarian assistance in Gaza. Empowered by the Zionist backers in Washington, the General's Starvation Plan aims to block the delivery of medical aid, food, fuel, and water to the besieged quarter, currently Jabalia Camp, where more than 20,000 people live. This is part of what appears to be a gradual genocide, while creating the illusion of allowing aid trucks into the northern area, as the U.S. ambassador informed the U.N. Security Council on Wednesday, October 16. The entry of aid trucks does not guarantee the delivery of food to the starving population. It means that Israel retains complete control over what section is fed and who is left to starve. It also confirms that American officials continue to be the Zionist regime's willing enablers to carry on with its general starvation plan in a systematic and phased mini-genocide.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz, every day, from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Southern Africa can tune in to the English service of the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day, from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is iranradio.ir. Thank you. now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, anger. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. This is Sister Zainab on A to Z with Iran Radio, speaking to you about anger. And in a sense, I'm going to be, maybe I'm just going to be trying to make you a little bit fearful about this. But I'll try to give a few sort of positive comments too. I'm going to start off actually with this positive thing about anger, just to remind you that there is also a side to anger. So all these traits that, remember, all the traits that Allah's given us, put in us, whether it's anger or envy, all these traits exist in us as sort of natural instinct. We're created that way. And part of our development towards perfection is that we're also supposed to overcome these. But that doesn't mean that we get rid of some of these things completely, because something like anger, so there is a purpose to anger. So there's the positive purpose. For example, without anger, we wouldn't have this ability to, for example, for survival, for example, to protect, to defend our nearest and dearest. So there's very good reasons why we have that. But obviously, on the path towards perfection or dealing with some of our really bad traits, we need to find this balance. We need to make sure that the negative aspects of these traits do not overcome, do not control us. So we know that anger can be very can escalate, can be extremely dangerous. Imam al-Sadaq said that anger is the key that opens the door to all kinds of vices. And when we have anger in this world towards people, towards things, we can be sure that we will experience divine wrath in the next, which is a very worrying prospect, of course, for us. And anger in itself, it's not just this heat, this excitement, this explosion that builds up in people and then maybe just embarrasses people. It can lead to other things. So you can imagine there are people who commit crimes, sort of, and they say the word there, the phrase that is used in English is that, you know, in the heat of the moment, so maybe someone had been harboring resentment towards someone and something bad happens, this particular person does something really bad, and then this person becomes so enraged, and in the heat of the moment, in this fit of anger and rage, they kill this other person. So it's a pretty serious thing. And for example, Imam Sadaq said that his father used to say that about anger, that a man gets angry and kills someone whose blood has been forbidden by God, or even slanders a married woman. So it just leads to all these other vices. Welcome back. This is A to Z on IRIB English Radio, and I'm talking about what anger does. Maybe you've actually experienced just a little bit of anger, and let's just be honest here. I don't know how many people that are out there have maybe experienced, let's say, a little bit of excitement or annoyance, or just a little bit of anger using their devices at times. Imagine you need to send something to work, or you're trying to send something even just to a friend, but if it's a work commitment, it's worse. And then for whatever reason, you can't connect to the Wi-Fi, or your devices are malfunctioning, they won't open, you can't get them to start, you shut them down, and so on. And think about whether you've ever experienced just a little, like almost a pinprick of anger. And obviously these things can blow out. So it's something that we're all born with. And there's a really nice tradition, for example, from Imam al-Sada. So he said that he once heard his father, Imam al-Bakr, say that there was this Bedouin who came to the Holy Prophet and who wanted to learn from the Holy Prophet, you know, the essence of wisdom as would be applicable for a person living in the desert. And the Prophet said to him, just don't get angry. And the Bedouin asked him again, is that it? So what is the important wisdom I need to know? And the Prophet again said, don't get angry. And then the Bedouin again asked him, just not believing that this could be so important. And the third time the Holy Prophet again said, do not get angry. So, you know, in this little story, we understand that this is something we need to focus on. And so I should maybe give you a little cure as to what we can do. So obviously we can reflect, but sometimes when we feel this little bit of anger rising, what they say is, for example, let's take right now, if I were to get angry, I'm sitting down. So what they would advise me to do if I were getting angry, I should stand up, or vice versa. If you're standing and you think you're getting angry at someone, then sit down. So inshallah, you've gained some insights from that, and I look forward to speaking to you again on A to Z, and Firman Allah, and farewell. Thank you very much for listening to this episode of A to Z. And for more information, please also visit our website at www.iranradio.ir. So
Palestine is where I belong.
The Zionist regime's continued assault is having a dramatic effect on pregnant women in Gaza and their newborns. More than 170 cases of congenital deformities in newborns were recorded during the last third of the ongoing Israeli war on Gaza, a worrying statistic. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Please stay tuned for more. The Electronic Intifada wrote, Samar Hamdan, who fled from Jabalia in northern Gaza Strip to Deir al-Balah in April when she was 4 months pregnant, was shocked when her baby girl, Noor, was born early with a congenital deformity. Hamdan told the Electronic Intifada, The doctors told me that my daughter has a good chance of survival, but she will live her life without hands and feet. Prosthetics are a medical possibility in the future, she said doctors had told her. They had also said that the likely cause of Noor's congenital condition were weapons used in Israeli bombings, specifically white phosphorus. Hamdan said, In the third month of pregnancy, I was exposed to gases emitted from white phosphorus, which was heavily dropped on us in northern Gaza. This is one of the reasons that may have caused the deformity, according to the attending doctor. She also said that the Zionist regime's genocidal violence, which has deliberately targeted Gaza's health sector, prevented her from getting the usual checks that pregnant women might normally expect. Hamdan said, I couldn't undergo ultrasound scans to detect such conditions before birth. Dr. Hatem Adher, head of the neonatal unit at Nasser Medical Complex in Khan Yunis, told the Electronic Intifada that Israel's continued assault is having a dramatic effect on pregnant women in Gaza and their newborns. More than 170 cases of congenital deformities in newborns were recorded during the last third of the ongoing Israeli war on Gaza, a worrying statistic, he said, of cases at Nasser Hospital alone, the largest in central and southern Gaza. The Zionist regime's use of internationally banned weapons in its attacks on the Gaza Strip has been documented by the rights group Euromed Monitor, including the use of cluster and phosphorus bombs. At Al-Auda Hospital in Nusayrat, northern Gaza, a medical team fought for months to save the life of Ahmad Al-Masri, a baby who was born with a congenital condition known as hydrocephalus, a buildup of fluid in the brain. Ahmad was born prematurely at 7 months, weighing just 1,400 grams. His mother, Safa, was unaware of her baby's deformities until he was delivered via C-section after she went into labor on September 13th. She gave birth 2 days later.
The doctors inform me that my baby's condition is critical, and most babies born with this condition don't survive because there is no treatment for such cases in Gaza, she said in an October interview. In November, and as a result of the Zionist regime's attacks on Al-Auda Hospital, Ahmad was released, with doctors saying they could no longer offer the care he needed and that the situation at the hospital was too dangerous. Safa is now, she said, hoping for a permit to take her son to Egypt. But he's just one of an estimated 14,000 patients in need of treatment outside Gaza, which has been all but hermetically sealed since the Zionist regime seized Rafah in early May and stopped any movement of people from Gaza. A distraught Safa said, "My child is waiting to travel to Egypt for treatment, but the only crossing for travel is closed, which threatens my child's life as his condition worsens day by day." Dr. Vessel Abu Laban, a pediatric consultant at Al-Auda Hospital, said the number of miscarriages and congenital deformities since the Zionist regime launched its genocide last year has shown a noticeable increase. One of the primary causes of these deformities, she added, is the inhalation of toxic gases from Israeli bombs, in addition to other factors such as exposure to X-rays and taking medications without medical consultation. And with Gaza's healthcare sector in ruins, there is little help for such babies, Abu Laban said. Due to the lack of medical resources in Gaza and the continued closure of crossings, many children born with congenital deformities die because they are unable to travel for treatment. Safa said her house in Rafah's Masbah area was bombed late at night without warning in March. The attack left her buried in rubble for 3 hours before she was rescued, she said. I was inhaling gases emitted from the missiles that struck the house, almost suffocating. According to The Lancet, a British medical journal, Gaza is suffering a staggering rise in premature birth, often triggered by the chronic stress of displacement, malnutrition, and the trauma of witnessing airstrikes. The authors found the near total collapse of the healthcare infrastructure, coupled with the lack of access to essential medical services, has resulted in a tragic surge in preventable material, neonatal, and maternal deaths, the authors found. Dr. Hossam Abu Safiye, the director of the Kamal Adwan Hospital in Beit Lahia in northern Gaza, said that during the last 6 months of the first year of the war in Gaza, his hospital had received 30 cases of newborns with various congenital deformities. He said, "The deformities affecting the newborns vary. Underdeveloped lungs and skull, hydrocephalus, and deformities in the digestive system." Abu Safiye, whose son was killed as Israel troops besieged the hospital late last month, but who is determined to stay, attributes these deformities to Israel's use of banned weapons in its aggression, as well as the lack of adequate health care for pregnant women due to the long siege in northern Gaza, which has been completely cut off from the rest of Gaza since the beginning of October. San'a Saddam, whose house in Jabalia was destroyed in an Israeli regime bombardment, was shocked when her son Karim was born on July 13, weighing 2,300 grams and suffering from congenital heart and lung deformities. The baby is receiving medical care at Kamal Adwan Hospital, but his condition is critical, she said doctors told her. Saddam said, "During my pregnancy, I was displaced more than 7 times. Each time, we evacuated quickly under continuous Israeli bombing. There is widespread fear among pregnant women of miscarriages at home due to heavy bombardments and their inability to reach medical facilities."
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is iranradio.ir. And now you can listen to Arabi English Radio by your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
This is the Heart of Life pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Hadith of the day.
Here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no more.
You are listening to the program Hadith of the Day on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Danesh, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Salam and welcome to this episode of the Hadith of the Day. My dear brothers and sisters, my friends, I offer my condolences to you and your families on this the martyrdom anniversary of Lady Fatima Zahra Salamullah alayha, the daughter of the Holy Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi, the wife of Imam Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali alayhi salam, and the mother to Imam Hassan, Imam Hussein, and Lady Zainab and Lady Umm Kulthum alayhim salam. But this doesn't define who she is. She is beyond just this, you know, these identifications. She is Fatima. She is defined by her own character, by her own purity, by her own greatness. And inshallah, you and I, all of us, will study her life and preserve and honor her legacy in our lives by following her example, inshallah. Today we're exploring a profound excerpt from one of the sermons of Lady Fatima Zahra Salamullah Alayha. This sermon reveals essential aspects of the spiritual status of the Ahlul Bayt and their role in guiding humanity. Let's dive into this message. She says, "Praise be to Allah, who by His greatness and light, all in heavens and the earth, seek means to approach Him. And we are His means, and we are His means among His creation. and we are his chosen ones. And we are the inheritors of his prophets. So, of course, this sermon is much more than this, but these are some phrases of it. In these few lines, Lady Fatima touches upon several significant themes. Let's break some of them. She first praises, begins by inviting us to praise Allah for his greatness and divine light. This opening sets the stage by highlighting that everything in creation seeks to get closer to God because of his unmatched majesty. It serves as a reminder of God's centrality in all aspects of existence and the innate yearning within all beings to seek him. And then she transitions to speak about the role of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam, stating, "We are his means among his creation." Here, Lady Fatima positions the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam as intermediaries or channels through which the creation draws closer to God. This idea is deeply rooted in Islamic teachings, where the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam are seen as the channels of divine mercy, guidance, and knowledge. So, dear brothers and sisters, how do we know God? From the most fundamental questions that we have about God, religion, everything, our connection with God, Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam teach us, from them to, many details in our everyday lives, everything. So they are indeed our intermediaries through which we can get connected to Allah. Inshallah, we would be their Shia. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
You just listened to the program Hadith of the Day on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Danesh, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد.
Bring us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
On Tuesday, after the expiry of a 30-day U.S. deadline for Israel to take steps to address the humanitarian situation in Gaza, Washington said Israel was not blocking aid to Gaza and therefore not violating U.S. law, and that the U.S. will not limit arms transfers to Israel as it had threatened to a month ago if the situation had not improved. That is while relief groups say conditions are worse than at any point in the 13-month-old war, and the global community and the UN itself have firmly condemned the blockade in Gaza as a clear violation of several, and not just one, international humanitarian laws. How could this brutal show of genocide and double standards go on with the international community basically just looking the other way? I am Bahman Roy, and in tonight's episode of Spotlight, we'll get to the bottom of the issue of the U.S. weapons supply to Israel. Allow me to introduce my guests. Scott Ritter, former UN weapons inspector in Iraq from Bethlehem, New York. And Daniel Kovalik, human rights lawyer, who is with us from Pittsburgh, Pasadena. Gentlemen, thank you so much for joining me on the show. Well, I'm going to start with Scott here. My question for you now is that, well, why did the U.S. even impose the 30-day deadline, you know, to now go through